Our guest, as I said, in this part of Focus 580 is Twyla Tharp. She is one of this country's best-known choreographers. Her first professional dance premiered in 1965. Since then, she has created ballets for a number of leading dance companies, including the Joffrey Ballet, the New York City Ballet, the Paris Opera Ballet, London's Royal Ballet, and the American Ballet Theatre. In the movies, she has collaborated with Milos Forman on Hair, Ragtime, and Amadeus. She also created the dances for the film White Nights, featuring Gregory Hines and Mikhail Baryshnikov. In television, she directed Baryshnikov by Tharp, which won two Emmys for Outstanding Director Achievement. On stage, she directed the theatrical version of Singin' in the Rain, also her recent collaboration with Billy Joel, Movin' Out, and that won a Tony Award for choreography in 2003. She's also authored an autobiography titled Push Comes to Shove and has a new book out now that is about creativity. And it's titled The Creative Habit, Learn It and Use It for Life. It's published by Simon & Schuster. It's just been out here officially, about a week or two. And in the book, she makes a very strong argument that against the idea that creativity is just something you're born with and some people have it and some people don't. She says that, in fact, That's not it at all. That creativity really depends on your willingness to work at it. And she writes about that in different ways in this book, suggests some exercises that you may try. And I think that you find it quite interesting. So you might want to take a look at it. It's in the bookstore now. And she's also talking with us this morning and joining us by phone. As we talk, questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. That's separate from pledging. So no one will expect you to pledge if you want to call in. You are welcome to do that. But of course, we hope people would pledge. That's not required. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Ms. Tharp, hello.
Hello.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure. Good morning.
I know you've been traveling today. You probably had kind of a long day already, so I appreciate it.
We're used to this.
I think maybe the thing I'd like to start out talking about is the idea of the muse, in the sense that I think that a lot of people, when they think about creativity and creative people, have this idea that it's somehow magical, and that it's something that's visited upon you, and it's not something that you have a great deal of control over, and it's almost like a mystical experience. And
right.
in many ways, maybe it is a little bit like that, but I think what you're really trying to do is make this strong argument that says, no, that's not really the way it is, that anyone can be creative, but it does take some effort.
Right. In the very beginning of The Creative Habit deals with Mozart, because if anyone in our culture is mythologically defined by this romantic notion that it all comes from the gods and not from the mortals' efforts, Mozart would be the prime case to make, because his music is indeed sublime and because he seemed to do it so effortlessly. But when one knows Mozart a little better, one is aware that Mozart was his father's son and that Leopold was an amazing mentor and had seen to it that by the time this child was 10 years old, the kid, who had a talent for music, there's no doubt of that, but the kid had been exposed to everyone writing music in Europe. He knew counterpoint, he knew harmony, he even had a humanist education, including a little politics and a whole lot of sociology. So he started his career very, very young and very, very prepared by way of an extremely sophisticated and fiercely determined parent. So that's number one. Number two is that Mozart early on loved music, clearly, and internalized all of these lessons, so that throughout his career, his habit structure, even though he lived a very chaotic life, his habit structure in relation to music was amazing, or he would never have been able to generate as prolifically as he did. So there you have it.
I think you do also make the argument that there is something to the notion that that the direction that you take is inborn. And you might say, well, that maybe that's why Mozart was a musician and not a painter. But that doesn't, but the sort, he wasn't born to be a great musician necessarily.
I do believe that he had a genetic edge in music, that he had an oral sophistication. He might also have had a visual sophistication. He was a very good writer. His letters are quite extraordinary, and his operas, of course, he was deeply involved with the libretti. So, you know, who knows what he had have been, would have been, had Leopold himself not been a very, very good musician who was also pedagogical. Leopold Mozart had written the recognized treatise on violin playing. So the guy was very firmly committed himself and dug a deep trough for Mozart to go through. The same is true of Bach. Johann Sebastian Bach had a family of many, many musicians, and all of them showed him the way.
Mm. How much do you think early childhood experience is important?
Huge. Mm. I think it's the key determinant. I think that a child who is recognized as having a special ability early, who's encouraged in it, who's educated in it, who's given skills, who acquires pride in his or her work, is a very, very privileged and special individual for life.
Mm. You know, one of the things that you suggest in the people that do, it suggests that people do, and it's here in the book, one of the various kinds of exercises is to write what you call a creative autobiography. And that consists of providing answers to a number of questions. There are 33, and they're questions that begin with the question, what is the first creative moment you remember? And you do this for yourself. You provide your own answers.
Right.
What is the first creative moment that you remember?
My answer to that question is before the age of one, sitting on my mother's lap for my ear training lessons. My mother was a concert pianist who was not allowed to pursue her career because of the war, and she started teaching. And she saw that I had what's called absolute or perfect pitch, and she figured, okay, this kid's got talent, let's go. So she started ear training before I was a year old. By the time I was two, I was out of the house, at a formal teacher's, doing my lessons, expected to practice, and yes, my mother, Liesl, was Mozart's father, Leopold, and she continued with this regimen until I was in college, not just in piano, but in dancing, in visual arts, in theater, and just to be sure she'd covered all her bases, I also had stenography, should all else fail.
So you could make a living if you had to.
Exactly.
Uh-huh. Did early on, though, did you feel pulled toward, drawn towards movement?
I always moved, and even at the same time as I was doing my little piano lessons, I was also doing my little violin lessons and my little percussion lessons and my little toe-tap lessons and my little hula lessons and et cetera. And you know what? I thought it was all the same thing. And I, in some ways, was blessed by having this, you know, this buckshot approach to education because I became a transactional person, which is to say, I can learn lessons in one place and apply them to another. My parents became business people. I watched how businesses work and what works and what doesn't work. I learned a huge amount from how music is structured for the dances that I make. And I learned from just bouncing around and moving that, you know, come on, let's go. And I found that I was a very physical child. So when I graduated from college, I graduated from Barnard in art history. I looked at myself and said, girl, what do you really want to do? And I said, girl, what do you do best? And I said, well, you know what? I think that the best thing you do is dance. I think you do that better than you do anything else. And I went, you got to be, yeah, I don't want to be a dancer. Well, this is no life. There's no career here. What are you, crazy? I said, it's the thing you do best. Mm. So I said, all right, I'll go for it.
For creative people, I'm sure that that a lot of people share the experience of the initial moment. That is, I would guess, you know, for the painter, it's the blank canvas. For the writer, it's the, I don't know how many people use typewriters, but, you know, it's rolling the blank piece of paper in there and sitting there and staring at a blank piece of paper. And
right.
I'm sure for you, it's going into the room where you work, a bare sort of room, an empty space, and standing there and then saying, all right, now what?
Right.
And for all of those people, I'm sure that can be a difficult and painful moment. And the key thing of getting started, and I think you talk about and other people talk about, once you manage to get over that initial hurdle, then you go. but that it can be extremely difficult. The first step,
right,
whether that's literal or metaphorical,
right,
that's very difficult.
Right, the oh my God factor.
Right.
Right. And I realized, and the second chapter of the book is called Rituals of Preparation, that what we're looking at here is fear, the fear that you're not good enough, the fear that someone is going to laugh at you, the fear that somebody's already done it, you're going to look foolish, the fear you're just not up to the task, or you're going to hurt somebody. Fear, 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 you know, procrastinative measures, anything but get down to business. And one of the ways to deal with the sense that you're not good enough and you're out of control, essentially, is to treat this moment ritualistically, because that's what primitive cultures did when they were faced with having to control the weather. They would offer ritual sacrifices. They would attempt to get everything in order that they could possibly manage in order that the rain comes, right? And I think that extended to the notion that ritual is preparation, you can indeed cope with the oh my God factor if you go into that room or you look at that blank page feeling as though you're prepared. You may not have yet the authority that says, okay, I can handle this task, but at least you can say to yourself, I've done everything possible to get myself here and be ready to go. I'm well rested. I am not fixated on a negative end. I have a sense that I will come out of here with something. And you have an idea, and you have something you're curious about. So then it's like, okay, all right, I may not be good enough, but I'm going to do the best I can do, and it's going to be something.
We have a couple of people who I think would like to have a chance to talk with you, and we will do that. Our guest is Twyla Tharp, very, very well known as a choreographer, and she's authored a book that is out now that's titled The Creative Habit, Learn It and Use It for Life, and it's published by Simon & Schuster. You might want to take a look at that. It should be in the bookstore right now. Questions here are welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Our first caller here in Urbana, where we are, line number one.
Yes, good morning. I have two questions, and why don't I ask them both, because they may be interrelated. My first question is, for those of us who are older and did not have the shotgun effect that you had of a rich cultural experience, what can people like, you know, us do who've just been, you know, thinking, I can't draw a line with a ruler, you know? And also, could you reiterate again the getting started? You just talked about it, and I'm not sure I got it down, but, you know, how you talk to yourself to get started. And I'll hang up and listen.
Well, thank you for your questions. I'll leave the recapitulation for just a bit later and try to deal with what we're calling a late starter. And I think that the first thing that anyone who has an instinct that they would like to add a little bit more to their life can do is, for example, in Philadelphia, I was doing a television interview, and Charlie the cameraman came over and said to me, you know, usually I shoot in this other direction, but I thought for you it would be nice to turn this around and put the piano behind you, and now I've redesigned the lights. And he said, I feel so much better about my day. And I'm going right on, because it's not just that in order to paint a painting or do something grand you need good habits. Look at the title the other way around. Look at the habits that you already have that are how perhaps your work is defined, and see how you can be a little more, quote, creative with them. How can you change them? How can you freshen things up? How can you challenge yourself a little more? And that doesn't mean you've got to redefine yourself as a composer. If, however, throughout your life you have felt that, my time is going to pass and I'm not going to have even tried to write the stories that I've always really suspected I could do, give yourself that chance and just be pragmatic about it. Set down a list of things you need to get started, okay? You probably don't need $1 million, but you probably do need some time. Carve it out. Make it for yourself. Take away all of the excuses that you've created, and then see how you do. And then maybe you'll realize that, hey, you know what, I'm really pretty happy with my life. Or maybe indeed you'll say, yeah, okay, I'm going to give it a shot. So I think that that is a way for the, forgive the language, but I mean it fondly, for the adult beginner to set about working. I myself am an adult beginner in several different arenas. I've always been curious about philosophy. I know absolutely nothing about it. I was not educated in this, but I had the good fortune to meet a gentleman who is head of the department at the University of Houston. So he and I now have a correspondence, and I have someone to whom I can turn with questions, and he in turn is very interested in, you know, a fool like me who knows absolutely nothing about Socrates from Kant, and so he's interested. And it's a mutual exchange. Open up your arsenal of opening questions. Start questioning things. I think that that is something we can all do. Age here, or background or preparation, don't feel victimized and handicapped by a childhood you feel could have been better educated. Get over it. You've got what you got. Use it. So that is my thinking about people who are coming later to the idea that they wish they were more creative. Get rid of the fantasy and get down to the reality. And in terms of addressing the empty space and recapitulating what I said about that, essentially it's this, that I think we often look at this as very intimidating, and it makes us fearful. And again, set your fears down. What are you afraid of? Exactly. Be rational about these fears. I think that they've sort of just been allowed to become a habit in and of themselves, and question them. Are people really going to laugh? And number two, how much do you care if people really are going to laugh? Because if you believe in what you're doing, that's what counts, not how it's going to be received.
Hmm. Well, I guess it's the experience of people who do stretch the boundaries of whatever discipline they're in, that seems almost inevitable that someone is going to come along and look at what they have done and say, well, this is no good. And maybe because it's being creative often involves breaking the rules and the established ways of doing things, and the people who have some vested interest in the rules,
exactly,
they're the ones who are going to say, well, this is no good. You can't do it like this. This is trash.
Right.
And you have to be a little tough, and at least willing to put up with the fact that someone is going to come along and say, well, this, what you've done, this is no good.
Yes, I think that we have to become adept at gauging criticism. Sometimes it's valid. Sometimes someone will have a valid point, but we must first ask, what is this person's agenda? Are they a status quo mind that needs things to keep going the way they are? And is that really what the argument here is? In which case, you can look at this and say, I've seen it before. But if indeed it's something that should be factored in, take it into account. Use criticism well.
We have another caller here. Let me just mention real quick that as this is the time of the year that we're asking for people to support the station, we hope that sometime this morning people will do that. And just as an incentive, at least to make a call, we do have an extra copy of this book that we're talking about here, The Creative Habit by Twyla Tharp. We'd like to find a home for the book, so we're going to have a drawing. The people who have called into the program so far, we've taken their names, and if you'd like to be in on the drawing, you can call. If you want to call on the air with a question, of course, that's great. Also, if you want to call our pledge line and make a pledge, that would also be very nice. It's not required, of course, making a pledge. So if you want to be in on this drawing, you can call in our show here, if you'd like to talk with our guest. That's 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Or if you'd like to call the pledge line, make a pledge or not, that's 244-9455. And we'll take the names of all the people who call, and we'll put them in a hat, and we'll draw out one winner. And with our thanks, you will get a copy of Twyla Tharp, The Creative Habit. And, of course, if you'd like to read the book, it's in the bookstores now. It's published by Simon & Schuster. So head out there and take a look at it. And, again, here, if you'd like to call in on the show, 333-9455 in Champaign-Urbana, toll-free 800-222-9455. We have a number of other callers. We suddenly have a bunch of people who want to talk to you.
All right.
Let's go next to Champaign and line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Hi. This is a topic I've been very interested in my whole life. I guess I don't have a specific question, although I would, an issue that I would like for the guest to address is along the lines of discussing one of the things I studied, and I actually did study philosophy, was the power of a word and what words actually mean. And one of those words that I've spent a long time with is the idea of genius, the idea of genesis and genius and creating something out of what appears to be nothing, and how oftentimes that is met with people, whether it be in a negative sense or in just dismissive terms, that what you're doing isn't along the norm. There was a song by a band called Radiohead, I think it was like 1990, they're on one of their on their first album, and the name of the song was something along the lines of "Anyone Can Play Guitar." And I've been a musician my whole life, and I was enamored with the idea that here's a band that many people are going to say, oh, these are geniuses, these are people who have done something completely innovative. But the fact of the matter is, and this is another issue that maybe you could discuss, that saying that or believing that creativity is a magical thing sort of dismisses the amount of work that goes in to doing something that's worthwhile. I know I'm able to play many instruments, and when people say, oh, wow, you just have a talent for that, I always think, I've spent 15 years of my life, day in and day out, teaching myself how to play these instruments, learning, reading, thinking about these, and there is a sense that for people who aren't able to do something, that you're able to do it because some magic happened to you. I personally started in the realm of music. I was grounded to my room by my parents, and I found a guitar and taught myself how to play guitar over the next year. And so there is, to me, the understanding that there's an enormous amount of work and commitment that goes into doing anything well is important as a recognition to artists, whether they be painters. I mean, I've recently endeavored to learn how to paint, and it's incredibly difficult to do in any talent at all. With, you know, to make it look like it looks in your head, there's just a lot more work than I ever gave it credit to painters for having. So that's one thing I would like the guest to talk about. And then the other thing, I guess, is just what does one do? I know that being creative, with myself at least, I feel like I've reached a level of ability that is worthy of some sort of note, and yet I've found now the difficult part is finding ways to publish or to get to the business end of things and take 3 years worth of novel writing and get it published or things like that. And I wonder if she could discuss that aspect of things. Once you've mastered or at least gotten to a point where you feel you're capable in a way that other people might be interested in carrying that out in another way. So I'll shut up now and listen.
Okay. Well, I'd certainly the first point certainly about just how much hard work goes into being creative is something that you address in the book. That's something that I think you're trying to get across to people too.
Yeah. No, this gentleman has said a mouthful. He's in fact said a bookful. And there are four things that I take from his remarks. First of all, the fascination with words and their roots. This is mentioned in the book under somewhat the rubric of scratching, which is a chapter that says, how do we get started? So if you take the root of the word genius, you'd probably come up with something in there that's got a little something to do with genetics, but I don't have an OED here, so I will drop that for the moment. I liked very much his quote about anyone can learn to play the guitar. Yes, and as he said, he taught himself to play the guitar, but still lurks in the back of our mind the suspicion that maybe, hey, you know what, I wouldn't do it so good, and maybe I don't enjoy it. If that is so, then perhaps the genius is not in music, but he found that he was interested enough in music to go ahead from that instrument to others. And so I would guess that he probably is pretty good on the guitar, that he's a pretty solid musician. His then wanting to extend that aptitude to a visual format, becoming a painter, and seeing how those lessons applied, he finds another chapter in the book called Skill. Oh my goodness, I've invested 15 years of my life in music, and now suddenly I want to transpose this visually. And while, you know, the heart may be in the right place, the chops, as they say in the music industry, are not there with the brushes. And that's a reality. But still, I'm sure that there are pleasures to be had from the painting that are not exactly the same from the music, and lessons to be learned and questions to be asked. So that's all to the good. Then the fourth component here, how do I turn this into both acknowledgement and income? And that, of course, is a whole nother matter. That is being entrepreneurial with one's artwork, and that is something that not everybody has managed to accomplish. Mozart was a terrible businessman. Beethoven was duplicitous and somewhat successful. Bach was not a particularly good businessman. Painters have been notoriously foolish with their work, and many writers have found themselves ripped off, certainly in the beginning. To also develop a good business skills at the same time as you're becoming a good artist or a good thinker is not easy. That's why the Ivory Tower was designed, and people went into university life to be basically taken care of so that they wouldn't have to bother with those details. On the other hand, not bothering with those details means that, in a way, the artist or the thinker is giving up a base of empowerment. We need to believe that we can take care of ourselves. So I think that it just becomes maybe a friend who is in management, or maybe a course in accounting. But don't think that you cannot do it. You just maybe have not yet focused on it.
Maybe I should introduce once again a guest for this part of Focus 580. We're talking with Twyla Tharp. She had the premiere of her first professional dance in 1965 and since has created many, many of them for many important companies. Is probably one of today's best-known choreographers. She's worked in movies, she's worked on stage, and has authored an autobiography, if you'd like to read more about her. It's titled Push Comes to Shove, and this new book that's titled The Creative Habit, Learn It and Use It for Life, published by Simon & Schuster. And that book has just recently come out. And we have a number of other people here who'd like to be a part of the conversation. You're welcome to do that. All you need to do is call us, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. We have a caller next in Aurora, and that is line number 4. Hello.
Yes, what a delight to speak with you with all your enthusiasm. I really appreciate it. I was one of those late starters. I started college at 53. After I did that for a while, I decided to put it into a career of nursing and graduated a nurse at 61.
Terrific.
And I want to go on to something else now. And I think one of the things that has helped me, I've started piano. I love to write. And I think the book Self Matters by Dr. Phil, I think if people realize that they matter, that they themselves matter to themselves, is a great thing to keep in your head. But I like what you said. You said creativity. What was that saying? Can I copy it down? Creativity?
Oh, I don't know. There have been so many sentences that had creativity in it. Can you paraphrase what you're thinking of?
Well, was it creativity, not negativity?
I'll buy that. I think we don't get very far if we think we cannot do it. And I think that your spirit of, getting up and teaching yourself a profession, and such a very special one as nursing, is a terrific way to push on into the future.
But now I really can't get into nursing, you know, because you do get older. You have to realize your limits.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to get into something more creative than the art of nursing.
Well, I think that if you look at your original instinct for wanting to become a nurse, it probably is a very creative one because it has to do with life and death. And that is, after all, the subject matter for all art in one way or another. And, in fact, I suppose we could extrapolate and say for all business. So, really, it's about morality. And if you feel you have a gift as a writer, I'm sure you have the content. So all you need is some practice.
Yes, yes. Thank you much. Love your program.
Right.
I'll get your book, too.
Well,
right.
thank you for the call. I just wanted, for a second, I wanted to go back to something, because earlier in the conversation you said, and you write in the book, that people, one of the things people have to do is confront their big fears. And you here in the book list your big five fears, and the first one is that, and you mentioned that earlier in the conversation, the first one is that people will laugh at me. And I guess I'm surprised for someone who has performed as much as you have and been in front of so many audiences, that still would be a big fear.
Oh, no one likes to feel humiliated publicly. So I think that it, however, is a good balancing act, because if you put whatever, I mean, maybe some folks don't mind about being humiliated, but instead would have the better judgment to say, this is not very good. I mean, on their own, to judge it that way. But whatever the biggest fear, put it on one end of the balance beam, and on the other put, I think that I really enjoy this, or I think this is really important, and therefore I will sustain, and I'll push through. I mean, you know, we stack up these fears in order to keep us really from having to work. Sometimes I think, even though I do appreciate and encourage and try to do as much of it myself, hard physical work, that in fact the body is going, well, wait a minute, this is like maybe more work than I want to do, so maybe people are going to laugh at me. You know, get honest with yourself.
Well, let's keep going here. We'll give other folks a chance to talk. We'll go next to someone in Urbana, line number 3. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Ms. Tharp, this is a special chance for me to thank you for your body of work.
Thank you.
I was always too shy to come backstage.
Oh.
But from the late 70s through the 80s into the 90s, my dance friend and I would come to your performances if you were within a 600-mile radius of Champaign-Urbana. And your work just gave me such joy. I never felt more alive than when I saw your performances and your companies. And I want to thank you very much, very, very much. You're my favorite American choreographer.
Well, thank you very much for the tribute, and I appreciate it. And ultimately, you know, having a connection to people such as you're describing is one of the supporting things that makes me say, okay, today I'm scared, but you know what? Somebody besides me is going to care about that, and this is important.
Please,
so thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you for the call. Let's go next to line number 1, and this would be Champagne.
Hi. I'm listening to this with a lot of interest. As a mother of a 10-year-old girl who's shown interest in a lot of things and not necessarily a tremendous aptitude in any, but never enough effort in any one thing to really see whether she's really interested or wants to continue. Oftentimes she'll start something and she'll just kind of give up. It's too hard. I don't want to, or not want to put the effort in where she's shown a little bit of positivity in the past. So how do you motivate someone at these young ages with the techniques that you describe in, or the things that you describe in your book? Do they apply to children as well as they do to adults? And I'll hang up and listen to your response. Thank you.
Well, no, thank you for your question. I would like to think that the exercises can be certainly applied to children, but let me go back to how you're describing your daughter's lack of motivation or follow-through, let's call it. I would ask, if I were you, first, of all of the dead ends that she has come up against, where was it that she seemed to take the most pleasure, that seemed to engage her the most strongly? Was it a physical action? Was it linguistic? Was it musical? And then I would check and see what kind of exposure was she getting. It is amazing how a bad teacher can cause a child to shut down. And I think that if your daughter had a real pleasure in something, you should perhaps reinstitute it one more time in another format with a different opportunity, with a different teacher. And I think that helping a kid define their goals and their dreams is, like, obviously as a parent, the biggest challenge that we have and the most rewarding goal. And it's kind of like never ending. The sooner that it can be not a disappointment that she quit, but a question, well, did you really, really mean to do that? And then if she did, fine. Find something else. But she has to give you a clue, and you have to keep asking the questions and keep pushing it through, because kids don't know. They don't know that just because it didn't work one time one way, there's another shot.
Okay. Let's talk with someone else. In Urbana, line number two. Hello.
Hello. I'm like the woman who called before, someone who've known about you from the Midwest since 65, and you, in fact, were my voice of terror. You know, oh, God, Twyla would look at me. Where's the turnout? Where's the mind that can remember things sharp as roses? Where's the lyricism of Sarah? You know, you were the person, and here you are sounding like an old woman talking about everyone can do it. I mean, that's an amazing gift, so generous, and yet a shock. How did I get so old? How could you be the... You're the one that goes out and then learns kickboxing.
Well, know? Right. Anyone can do it, but I didn't say that anyone could dance as well as Sarah or could dance as well as Rose. I'm very pleased that you remember them, because they were truly extraordinary. And they made that choice for themselves. It wasn't something that I did. It was something they wanted to have, and I've always been very honored and lucky to have such gifted people around me. In terms of maturing, which I prefer to aging, so you can go either way, but, you know, maturing seems to mean we got something in the cup and there's a little more going in rather than the other way around. Just means that you see, as you have experiences, that there are 1,001 ways to skin a cat, and then pretty soon 1,010, and then 2,000, and you know what? You don't know all of them. So let's get real in giving other people different kinds of credit, and maybe in the beginning kids are defensive and do feel like, okay, I got to have all the answers. It's got to be my way or else nothing is going to work, because they're intimidated. And that as we mature, we gain insights to go, yeah, my way works, but you know what? So does that other way over there. So I think that that is the answer to your question about how one can continue to be engaged, and it's curiosity.
Well, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Something that you, Ms. Tharp, you deal with in the book that really struck me, and I think that it's an important idea, is that to get yourself into the space to be creative involves some deliberate effort. It may well involve breaking out of your normal routine, and it really should involve trying as much as you can to eliminate distractions, and as we all know, there are so many in life and so many demands, so much stuff coming at us. We are so overstimulated that it's very difficult for us to hear ourselves, and that what you have to do is to make it possible to do that is perhaps indeed pare back, eliminate distractions, and put yourself in a place that's quiet enough so that if you do have some inner voices, you can hear them.
Right, absolutely. It's a balancing act. On the one hand, obviously, we want input, and we want information, and we want preparation. And on the other hand, we have to come at a certain time to evaluating and go right up against the wall and say, what do I think? And at times like that, yes, I do work hard to eliminate all distractions. No TV, no newspaper, eating only really what's necessary, no evenings out, a very strict, in fact, monastic kind of routine until I can really believe myself, and then I'm ready. I do pass through phases. I certainly don't recommend to anybody the last chapter in the book, which is called The Long Run, deals with a condition I call the bubble, which is this kind of monomaniacal focus and fixation, this obsessive need to be self-contained. You can't do it, or at least I can't do it, all the time, and yet there is a certain point in a project where I feel this kind of pressure has to be put on to a project, and it's like tempering the sword in fire. You construct a thing, and then you have to give it a real test run.
Well, I think we're just about at the point that we're going to have to finish. I think you've certainly offered people a lot to think about in this book, and I would encourage people to go out and look at it. And again, the very basic idea, the most important one, is that that one should feel that the potential to be creative, that everyone has it.
Absolutely. And that it's everyone's responsibility and pleasure to utilize.
Well, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.